So this is the fastest I've ever gone through a book before. Hopefully that we're picking up something as we go through. We will be beginning in chapter 38 tonight, going through chapter 43 is the plan. And so we'll see what we can do to that end. Again, we're in kind of the last section, the home stretch here with this book and dealing with the blessing of Judah and Jerusalem. And going back to this coming back, God talking to the theme to them about coming back from captivity, back from where they've been, and the love of God. And so the people will know His righteousness, will know My name. We'll see that theme repeated over and over again, even tonight, and that the nations will know My name and My holy name, and we'll see that several times. We'll also see some things concerning prophecy, things that will tie in with the book of Revelation, and so it'll be fun. And so we'll get through this together tonight. So we're going to look at chapter 38, and we're going to see a name that you might have heard of before and probably heard of out of context quite a bit. Prophecy against Gog. It's not a misspell of anything. So Gog and Magog, have you heard of them before? Gog and Magog going to a boat? No, not that kind of thing. But anyway, so Gog and Magog, we're going to be looking at this prophecy here. And so we have, beginning of verse 38, and the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face toward Gog, the land of Magog. And you may have in your translations, in New American Standard and some others have Prince of Rush, or you may have the chief of the princes in King James, New King James. Meshach and Tubal, prophecy against him. So we have this kind of region that's being spoke of, this area. And there's some differences here about the translation, whether it's chief, prince of, or what's being stated here. This area that's being referenced is possibly the area between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, kind of up north in that area. These are kind of actually referencing possible descendants of Japheth as well. But he says, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. I will turn you about and put hooks in your jaws. So this is a visual kind of concept that God's in control. Right? I'm going to steer you where I want you to go, with hooks in your jowls and turn you the way I want. And so he begins talking about their army here. What nations are mentioned here in verse 5 that we might have heard of before? Persia, Ethiopia, and you might have put there, that's actually the third son of Ham and the descendants of Ham. Nehemiah chapter 3 verse 9 talks about that nation as being helpers of Egypt. And so we have, verse 6 says, Gomer, or the area that is around Galatia possibly, with all its troops, Beth Gomorrah, from the remote parts of the north. And so we have nations mentioned from the south, nations mentioned from the north. We see those kind of nations being mentioned here. So we have this, be prepared, verse 7, be prepared and prepare yourself, you and all your companies that are assembled about you, and be on guard. After many days, verse 8, you will be summoned in the latter years. It'll come into the land that is restored. Look at what is the state in verse 8? What is the state of God's people in verse 8? Where are they? What's that? Where are they? They're gathered. State of God's people, says they're gathered from many nations, from the mountains of Israel, which have been continual waste, but its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. And so we're seeing this kind of secure state, the secure location of God's people in this area. And verse 9 begins talking to Gog and says, you will go up, and you will come like a storm. You'll be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops, and many peoples with you. And thus says the Lord God, it will come about on that day, and the thoughts will come into your mind, and you will devise an evil plan I will go up against a land of unwalled villages. Why would somebody want to go up against a land of unwalled villages? Yes, easy pickings, right? So here's a people that have come back from captivity. And when they came back, we know historically when they came back from captivity, what did they have to do? They had to rebuild, right? It was a huge labor campaign, right? So they had to rebuild the temple, they had to rebuild the walls and that kind of stuff. And we're not so much alluding to that, but we could be alluding to the fact that here's a people who's living in security with God as their protector, right? I'm going to go up against, because God at one point says, I'm going to be their wall, I will protect them. So here's a land, here's a people who are living in this land. God has brought them out of captivity. He is the guard around them. And that's really kind of the focus of what we're going to be looking at in verses 38 and 39, is that God is the protectorate of his people. And he will watch over his people. And so here they are in unwalled cities. They're living this peaceful life. You know, you've seen cartoons with the flowing green grass and the sparkling waters and kids running around with kites and everything's happy and awesome. And that's Israel, right? And then in the cartoon, there's this, you know, cloud that's coming and the armies that are approaching. And that's Gog and all his, you know, maybe you've watched Lord of the Rings. You know, it's that kind of thing coming against this peaceful people. And so we're going to see what happens. But what is he saying in verse 11 and 12? Even into 13, what is coming to the heart of Gog to do to this peaceful nation? To plunder, right? To plunder them, to take the spoils. It's easy pickings. And so he actually says in verse 12, who have acquired cattle and goods, who live at the center or navel of the world. Again, why do we call Israel kind of the center point? Why do we talk about, why are they mentioned as that kind of center point? God's with them. Just think geographically, why do we call them the center point? There's a mountain, yes. But if you look at a map, you go back to your Bible maps that you use all the time, I'm sure, and you'll see Israel is in between, like you have all Africa essentially to the south, and all the nations, Ethiopia and those that were kind of mentioned. Then you have all the nations to the north, Assyria, Persia, and even, you know, the Galatians and those other nations that are mentioned here. And you have little old Israel kind of centered there in the middle, right? To go between those two large nations, if you're going to go by land, you have to go through Israel, right? They are sort of a center point. They are a gateway nation. And so for them here, when he's saying that they're centered in the navel or the center of the world, they're sort of point like right there in the center. And so people have to travel through there if you're going to go by land, because you can't just go around Israel to one direction, right? What's out kind of to the west of Israel? There's water and then desert, right? You got on either side. So you got sort of those kind of things, those hindrances. And so that's kind of why they mention here the center of the world. And the other people are asking, verse 13, are you going to go up and capture them and spoil? Are you going to take and capture them? So that's the idea. Verse 14, we have this prophecy. I'm skipping ahead here. So we talk about the intent of Gog, verses 10 through 13, and then this destruction of Gog. He says in verse 14, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel are living securely, will you not know it? You will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great assembly and mighty an army. And you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. The second time we've seen that. And it shall come about in the last days that I will bring you against my land, so that the nations may know me when I am sanctified. And so this seemingly is kind of sort of like a God saying, this is going to happen, but the nations will know when I wreak vengeance upon you that I am sanctified, that this is my holy city. You can't come against my holy city. And so he says, are you one of them like I spoke in former days through my servants, the prophets of Israel, who prophesied in those days many years that I would bring you against them? So there's many prophecies about nations coming against Israel, right? If you want to write it here, Joel 3, 9 through 16. Not that this is specifically talking about that, but there's many prophecies about nations coming against Israel. And we're going to get into and see here in a moment that this is not a literal, it's not a literal nation coming against Israel. This is God saying, talking about His protection over Israel. And we'll tie this in later on and kind of bring us in. But you're seeing these details, but this never actually happens. There's never this leader of Gog, called Gog, that comes against the people of Israel. That never happens. But what does happen is God assuring His people that when you come back, you will be under My protection. And so we're going to be looking at some of that in just a moment. But look in verses 18 and 19. What do we see about God? What does He say about my fury, my anger, my zeal, my blazing wrath? Why do people need to be reassured? They've been taken into captivity. Why do they need to be reassured of anything? What's that? They've been living with pagans. They have been victims. And as David mentioned, they'll be victims for 70 years living in this land. And so they're coming back. Have you heard of anybody being shell-shocked before or post-traumatic stress syndrome? So God is saying to them, you will be under My protection. Even though something like Gog may come against you, look at what is going to be happening to them. And so we see this kind of destruction. What is mentioned here as far as what does God use to wreak His havoc upon Gog? What does He use? What things are mentioned here? Earthquakes. And not just a little earthquake, right? This is like a big one. He says, I declare, verse 19, that on that day there will be surely a great earthquake in the land of Israel. The fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the field, all creeping things that creep on the earth, and all the men who are on the face of the earth will shake at My presence. The mountains also will be thrown down. Do you want reassurance from God? Yes. When anybody comes against you, and I come against them, God, the earth will shake at My presence. And so we see this. It says, I will call for a sword, verse 21, verse 22, with pestilence and with blood, and also a torrential rain, hailstones, fire, brimstone. Verse 23, I will magnify Myself, sanctify Myself, and make Myself known in the sight of many nations, and they will know that I am the Lord. And we see this kind of promise of protection from God in this. And again, through all of the book, there's this God wanting the nations to know that He is a Lord. That Israel needs to know that He is Lord, and that He is ruler and supreme. And so we have this in chapter 38. And in 39, we transition into still continuing talking about the destruction of Gog. And he says, and you, son of man, beginning of verse 1, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince, Rosh, Mesh, and Tubal, and I will turn you around and drive you, take you up from the remotest parts of the north and bring you against the mountains of Israel. I will strike your bow from your left hand and dash down your arrows from your right hand. You will fall on the mountains of Israel. You and all your troops and the peoples who are with you, I will give you as food to every kind of predator, predatory bird and beast of the field. Now remember, what were the things that God used to wreak havoc and pestilence against the people of Israel? Do you remember what the three were? The sword, pestilence, and beasts of the field, right? And so he's mentioned between chapter 38 and 39, he's mentioned those things as well as earthquakes, torrential rain, and hailstones, and, you know, lions and tigers and bears. So all the things, right? All the things are coming against them. And so you will fall. And you will fall, verse 5, in the open field, for it is I who have spoken, declares the Lord, and I will send fire upon Magog and those who inhabit the coastlands in safety, and they will know that I am Lord. So it's not only that he's coming from this area and coming down to attack Israel. He's saying, I will even send fire upon your homeland, right? Not only will you be destroyed, the armies will be destroyed, but your homeland will also be destroyed in this process and what's going to happen. In verse 7, my holy name, do I have it up here? My holy name I will make known in the midst of my people, Israel, and I will not let my holy name be profaned anymore. And the nations will know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. And so again, there's this huge display by God saying, I will protect my people. I will take care of my people, and they will not be profaned. My name will not be profaned anymore. And so we begin to go into in verse 9. It says, those who inhabit the cities of Israel will go out and make fires with the weapons and burn them, both shields and bucklers, bows, arrows, war clubs, spears, and for 7 years they will make fires of them. What is this verse saying? What is this verse saying? So the armies of Gog have been decimated, and God's people are going to go out, and for 7 years, they're going to be able to cook their cakes and bake their bread on the weapons of war of the army that came against them. What is he saying in that? What's that? They're going to have peace, right? They're going to have peace. That this huge, this, he's talking about the extent, the size of this army and God's utter destruction of them, right? Utter destruction. And so they will not take wood from the field or gather firewood, verse 10. They'll make fires with all these weapons. And verse 11, on that day I will give Gog a burial ground there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by east of the sea. And again, this is important because if east, just east of the sea, is it just east? Yes. So just east of the sea is there's the Highway of the Kings, which is one of the ways of, that you would travel, traverse that area with a great army. And so he's talking about specific areas that they'll be traveling. And so he said they're going by that way. And so he says they'll block off those who will pass by. They will bury Gog there with all his horde. And they will call it the Valley of Hamon Gog, which Hamon means horde or company. And so this is the valley where Gog and all his army is buried. What does he say beginning of verse 13 and 14? Well, I guess 13 through 15. What are they doing as far as burying the people? What processes are they using? What are they doing? Yeah, so there's going through and they're burying it. Look in verse 15, and those who pass through the land pass through, and anyone who sees a man's bone, then he will set up a marker. Like in my mind, there's this long line of people going through this valley, and they have those little white flags with metal sticks, and just saying, all right, here's one, right? And then people come behind them and start burying those bones. Because there's that many dead people out in this field, they need to bury and cleanse that field. That's in my mind what I'm seeing. But that's what they're doing. They're going through and burying all these people. How does that build confidence into the people of Israel? Oh man, we're going to be out burying people for forever. Why does that build confidence in God's people? Yes, here's a reminder: God will fight for you. God will fight for you, and we see that even when Nehemiah, you know, and Sanballat and Tobiah come against them, our God will go before us, and God will fight for us. And that's where this kind of concept, his concept, when he's mentioning that, comes from this kind of idea that our God goes before us, right? God did that whenever they were even going in and liberating the land and taking over the land. God went before them. And so he's alluding to that again, that this is something that he will be doing before them. And they're just going to go in and clean up the mess, right? They're just there to clean up the mess and cleanse the land. Yes, sir. Did you all hear that? And so the people of Israel were not a huge fighting nation. They were not a huge people, even coming back out of captivity. During, I guess, the time of David, maybe they had some training as far as being warriors. But when they came out of the land of Egypt, were they all warriors to the man? No. And then coming out of captivity, had they been trained as warriors in order to defend themselves? No, they were not trained warriors to defend themselves. They were not. That's why, you know, whenever he says, you know, they have unwalled cities, they were easy pickings. They were not prepared for this type of battle. And God says, I'm going to be the one that will stand and fight for you. I will be out there for you. So that's exactly right. And then verse 17, through the end of the section, 17 through 24, we see the beasts of the field kind of get their day in the sun. It says the beasts of the field will not be satiated, will be gluttoned upon the blood and the fat of all the armies that died there. So it gets rather graphic as far as how, you know, the nature cleans up a mess like that. But all these beasts, the birds of the bird and every beast of the field, will come together from every side, in verse 17, to my sacrifice, which I'm going to sacrifice for you as a great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel, and you'll eat flesh and drink blood, and you'll eat flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, as though they were rams, lambs, goats, bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan, and you will eat the fat until you're glutted and drink blood until you're drunk from my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you. So again, this is just the utter destruction of, and really speaks to the protection of God. Verse 21, and I will set my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see my judgment, which I have executed at my hand, which I have laid on them. And the house of Israel will know that I am the Lord their God from that day onward. That's what he wants them to know. That's what he wants them to take and hold close to them and understand that God is God is their Lord and their protectorate. And then verse 23, the nations will know that the house of Israel went into exile for their iniquity because they acted treacherously against me, and I hid my face from them. And so this thing that's happening in Israel is not a secret. What God is doing to his people as far as judging them was not a secret. Other nations needed to know how God worked and took care of his people, but you know they were treacherously against him, and he hid his face from them. And so that's why we have in the beginning of verse 25 this kind of brief image into a restored Jerusalem. Israel will be restored. Because now I will restore the fortunes of Jacob and have mercy on the whole house of Israel. Verse 26, they will forget their disgrace and all their treachery. Verse 27, when I bring them back, and then shall I be sanctified through them in the sight of many nations, then they will know that I am the Lord their God. So over and over again, this concept is being stated. And so again, this idea with Gog and Magog is something that is mentioned over in Revelation chapter, 21:1-6. But again, the same kind of concept is used in Revelation with chapter 20, beginning of verse 7. When the 1,000 years are completed and Satan is released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for war, and the number of them is like the sand of the seashore. And they came up on the broad plain of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and beloved city, and the fire came down from heaven and devoured them. And the devil who deceived them had thrown down the lake of fire and brimstone with the beast and the false prophet also, and they were tormented that day and the night forevermore, forever and ever. So this concept of Gog and Magog is used in the Old Testament to show God's protection of his holy city, of his people. It is used again in Revelation to show God's protection of his holy people. It's not a literal group of people that are coming up against them. It is just God showing his protection of his people. And so again, we see that tied over into Revelation as well. So that's an important, so two chapters that were kind of summed up in one verse in Revelation, but to get the idea that God is protecting his people, and very graphically, and to a great degree, so the nations will know that he is Lord. So we'll go over to chapter 40, and we start sort of a very different section in the book of Ezekiel. This starts off with a date. It says, in the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th month, in the 14th year, after the city was taken, on the same day the hand of the Lord came upon me. Now, what have we been dating? What have we been using as a date up until this point? We've been talking about a king's exile, right? When the king was taken into exile, it was used as a dating point. And now he's talking about when the city fell. And so that became a bigger event to mark as far as destruction. So this is, if you want to know the calendar date, April 28th, 573, if you want that out there, April 28th, 573 is what we're looking at. And so in verse 2, in the visions of God, he brought me into the land of Israel on a very high mountain. And so we're getting into this vision state as well. And he brought me there, and behold, there was a man whose appearance was like the appearance of bronze, and a line of flax and a measuring rod in his hand, and he was standing in the gateway. The man said to me, Son of man, see with your eyes, hear with your ears, give attention to all that I'm going to show you, for you have been brought here in order to show it, declare to the house of Israel all that you see. And so now we're going to embark on this long sort of measuring of everything that is holy process for the next few chapters. And so we'll be looking at that. But I want to look at something real quickly before we start this. Look over in Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11. Chapter 11, verse 1. There was given me a measuring rod like a staff, and someone said, get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it. Then look over as well in chapter 21. Chapter 21, verse 15. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its wall. The city was laid out as square, and its length was great and its width. And he measured the city with the rod. 1,500 miles, its length and width and height are equal. All right. So we're starting into a section of Scripture that's similar in that we are dealing with measuring these things. Measuring, we're going to start measuring the temple, measurements of everything. And that is something we also see in the book of Revelation, a measuring of something. Why do we need the dimensions? And incidentally, I'm going to just kind of fast forward here for you. These dimensions are not dimensions that are ever built. Like when they come back to rebuild the temple, they do not build them to these dimensions. And these dimensions don't match up with dimensions necessarily that we see in Exodus and that we see in other places. And so these are not similar dimensions. They're quasi-similar in proportion, but not the same dimension. Why do we need to know about the measurement of something? We're in captivity right now, and you're giving us blueprints of something that we can't see right now. And why do Christians need to know about the measurements of heaven? Something we can't see right now. What's that? Hope. The promised land, they got taken out of it, right? And they are pilgrims in a strange land. And they will eventually have been promised that they will go back to that promised land. And that will be their people, right? And we see that even in this book. We are pilgrims in a land. We want the measurements. We want to know what heaven is like. God said it's going to be like this. So these are not dimensions that are going to be translated to the people for them to build the temple according to these dimensions. It is to give them hope. It is to give them, like, you will come back and it'll be great and it'll be grandiose and I'll be with you. The people who received the letter of the book of Revelation, did they want hope? Yes. Did they want to know that they're going to eventually go to a great and beautiful place? Yes. And so that's a similar kind of idea that we're diving into right now. So we're not going to get lost in the measurements, right? We will not see on a prophet, king, or priest card any of these measurements for these things. Yes, ma'am. Yes, it helps them visualize. So you're dealing with people eventually that have, you know, so we're at 25 years, you know, when this, so you have people who are in their mid-20s that have never seen the temple, right? Have never seen the grandeur of Solomon's temple. And so, again, giving them hope and giving them that kind of encouragement. And so we see that. And so, we begin measuring here in chapter 40 So we have this man with the measuring rod, and then we begin measuring the outer temple, and we start measuring the width, and start measuring the different gates. And so he goes into the inner court, verse 17, and start measuring the inner court. And so it's as though we're traveling around the wall and measuring the gates and measuring everything. And so we start seeing all these things that are taking place here. Did I skip something very important? I might have. Nope, that's in 43. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. So we're starting to measure all these different things. And again, we're not going to get caught up in the measurements and trying to compare them. I will in a moment have a picture of what the, like an artist's rendition of what this might have looked like as far as these measurements. And so we're starting to see these things. And he gets taken to the inner court in verse 32 toward the east. And then we start seeing all these things. Look in verse 38. So the chamber was with its doorway. The side pillars of the gates that were there, they rinsed the burnt offering there. And so we see kind of even like the details of just priestly service is mentioned here. In 39, talking about the tables on which they slaughtered the burnt offerings. And so we get into very detailed information about what this temple is going to have in it and what's going on and talking about these tables. And then in verse 45, he said to me, "This is a chamber which faces towards the south, intended for the priests who keep charge of the temple. But the chamber which faces towards the north is for the priests who keep charge of the altar. These are the sons of Zadok, who from the sons of Levi came near to the Lord to minister to him." If you want to write out here, we don't have time to get into this, write out here to the side, you know, there was a change, kind of a shift in sideways between where the priest that ministered to them kind of came. If you want to write it here, 1 Samuel chapter 2, 27 through 36. 1 Samuel chapter 2, 27 through 36. Also 1 Kings 2, 26 through 35. And it's during the time of Ezra, obviously, that they come back, and that priesthood is going to start back again. And Ezra chapter 7 gives us actually the lineage of the priest who's coming back, the high priest who's coming back, and he's from this line. He's from this lineage of people that serve him. And so that's Ezra chapter 7, verse 1. And so this is an important note. It ties way back into the history of events. And so it's mentioned here. It's important to have these verses here. So that's Ezra chapter 7, verse 1, that actually, as far as that being the lineage of people that serve God. And then so he goes in verse 48 is to the porch as well. So they go all the way around the outer wall of the temple. In chapter 41, we get to the inner temple, start measuring the walls that are there and the chambers, the measurements of the temple and the woodwork of the temple. And this is interesting. Beginning of verse 21, the doorposts of the nave were square as for the front and the sanctuary. The altar was of wood. It talks about the altar there. And the nave and the sanctuary of the door. Verse 25, each of the doors had two leaves, two swinging leaves, two leaves for one door and two leaves for the other door, which means they were hinged doors, right? So that's interesting. Also carved on them were the doors of the nave, cherubim and psalm and palm trees. Like those carved on the walls. And there was a threshold of wood on the front porch or the outside, latticed windows. And so we start even down to the detail. So this is the imagery that we're given, but even down to the detail as far as what was being carved on them. You have the sun on the cherubim. You have the face of a man on one side and the face of a young lion on the other side. And so a lot of detail is going into this. Chapter 42, you have the outer court and the chambers being measured and those things that are being going around. Again, it's going around the city and measuring everything. And then you have verses 15 through 20, these final outer dimensions of this building. And here is sort of if an artist's rendition of what it might have looked like if you, and again, we haven't read everything yet. And another reason why this is not literal is that later on we'll read about a river that comes out from underneath the altar. And you know, so it's obviously we're not dealing with a literal type of physical thing that's going to be built. but this is an artist's rendition of what that might have looked like. So they interpret those measurements and everything and put them in a program, I guess, and this is what popped out. This gives you an idea. This is easier to see, right, than reading those chapters. Did you guys have this in mind whenever you were reading those chapters? Did you guys have this picture in your mind? I sure didn't. I got lost after a few verses. So I was like, what are we doing? What's a span? Okay, so 5 minutes. All right. Go in chapter 43. The return of God's glory. Why is this significant? Well, beginning in verse 1, then he led me to the gate facing toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east. His voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, he came to destroy the city. That's in chapters 8, 9, and 10, when he destroyed the city, when he was back in the vision before. Specifically chapters 8, 9, and 10. And the visions were like the vision which I saw by the river of Chebar, and I fell on my face. That's chapter 1. We read about that vision. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by way of the gate facing toward the east. This is significant because in chapter 10, verse 18, the presence of the Lord had left. Chapter 10, verse 18, the presence of the Lord had left. Why is that significant? I'm no longer with you. I'm not here to protect you. You're on your own. You wanted to do this on your own. You wanted to make your own little puny gods. Have them, right? I'm out of here. And so God left and left them to the judgment and sent judgment upon them. And he was not there. His Shekinah glory. So the glory, when the temple was consecrated, there was this glory that came upon the temple. There was this presence. They could physically see that God was there. When God was leading them in the desert, they could physically see that he was there. His glory was there. His presence, his glory was even upon, obviously, Moses, and his face shone. And so that concept, the presence of God, God's glory in the temple, meant that God was with his people. And so now he's saying, you're going to come back. And not only are you going to come back, but I'm coming back. I'm coming back. We'll be back in that relationship again that we had before if, you know, we all do our part and do what we're supposed to do and play nice, right? So this is what's supposed to... It came into the door facing the east, and his spirit was there. And so this is significant that God is coming back to the temple. Not only are the people coming back, not only is he promising that they will come back, but God is saying, I will be back in this temple. And so we see the measurements of the altar. And if you want to write out here Exodus chapter 27, verses 1 through 8, just to see that these measurements don't at all mess up. The altar they were making in Exodus was a mobile altar, right? This was more permanent, so it's not at all the same. And then you have the cleansing of the altar, the sacrifices that are supposed to be made when the altar is done. Again, verse 19, mentioning offspring of Zadok will draw near to me and minister to me in that time. And it talks about the specific sacrifices that will be made in that time. Again, reassuring them, you're coming back. Things are going to return to normal. Have you heard of that? Has that been a theme? Okay. So things will return. We will come back. There will be a coming back. We will have this relationship again. Sacrificial offerings will be reinstated. That will happen. Things will return to normal. Now, whenever they actually do come back and rebuild the temple, it's not anywhere near the grandeur of Solomon's temple. And it doesn't even come close until much later on. And Herod kind of does his I Want to Win Over the Jews campaign and builds the temple even bigger. So it is not that this is what's going to be rebuilt. It is just a promise of future relationship and a hope that's being given to these people to come back. Very similar to us in the book of Revelation in that, you know, these measurements of heaven and things that are given to us to see that that's a hope that we get to go to. Any comments, thoughts, shout-outs, anything? All right, thank you very much for your time tonight. Appreciate it.